attacking us, can you give us a question? Mr. President-elect.
Go ahead.
Mr. President-elect, since you are attacking our news organization, you give us a chance?
Your organization
You are attacking our news organization.
Your organization.
Can you give us a chance to ask a question, sir?
Go ahead.
Sir, can
Quiet.
You state, can, Mr. President-elect,
go ahead.
Can you state categorically,
she's asking a question. Don't
Mr. President-elect, can you give us a question?
Don't be rude.
You're attacking us. Can you give us a question?
Don't be rude.
Can you
no,
give
I'm not
us a question?
I'm not going to give you a question.
Can you state categorically?
You are fake news.
Sir,
go ahead.
Can you state categorically that nobody... No, Mr. President-elect, that's not
go
appropriate.
Ahead.
Jazza, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year! 2017. It definitely won't be more shit than 2016.
I mean, should we start with predictions for this year? Do you think it's going to be worse than...
Well, obviously, because all of the stuff that kind of happened in 2016 finally actually gets to come and around and be real in 2017.
So,
like, President Trump
mm-hmm.
is not president yet.
Okay.
It's going to be president very, very soon. Brexit hasn't happened yet. It's going to happen very, very soon. Well, not as soon. Well, we'll see.
But you know, sometimes the anticipation of bad events is worse than the actuality of them.
Correct. Although I will say that Trump particularly, I think, will be worse than we're anticipating.
Well, some people have anticipated he's going to start a nuclear apocalypse. So if he doesn't do that, he'll be doing better than some people's predictions.
I'm just hoping that he gets kicked out or bored before anything can vaguely escalate.
We were actually having a discussion in my office earlier this week about whether he would serve his full term, whether he might get assassinated or impeached or just resign, actually.
I can see him getting really bored. I can see him being like, no, I don't actually like this gig. I think he'll hate being president. It's very serious. It's not about you all the time.
So you don't think he's going to make the...
I don't think he'll make 4 years. But then Mike Pence is also terrifying. Like has policy decisions that aren't... Like, the wall is stupid, but it's pretty benign.
Mm.
Like, people aren't going to die because he built a wall. People aren't going to be, like, repressed, apart from not being able to, like, come across the border
right.
because of a wall. Mike Pence really hates gay people and doesn't think that abortions should happen. And...
So you're thinking that Trump is now the safeguard against Pence?
Oh, God, yeah. Actually, yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Isn't that terrifying? Anyway, hello. Welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast. Wanted to seed you with some horrific thoughts before...
Some of our world-famous predictions.
Yeah. I mean, my ones are world-famous now.
I mean, you did predict those two events, but actually with Trump, you didn't really hedge your prediction particularly. You just said he's going to win, whereas you should have said there's an X percentage of chance of him winning and X percentage of...
Sorry, I hadn't learned statistics yet.
I'm just saying, like, you couldn't have been sure. It's like, if I flip a coin and you call it...
You're wanting me to do, like, the 538 thing, but those
yes.
guys can do maths. I can't divide.
That's why I just followed their statistics. I just said, well, those guys are probably right.
Yeah, and they actually were right, because they fell within the... Well, it was, if you flip three coins, one of those coins is Trump, and we got the third coin.
Indeed, yes.
Anyway, I'm Jazza, hi.
I'm Jimmy.
And at the Right Dishonourable podcast, this thing that you're listening to, we talk about politics, current events, and social issues.
All three.
All three.
Sometimes at the same time.
Yeah, hat trick.
So what are we going to be talking about this week?
Trump... Surprise, surprise.
Yeah.
Seeing as that's at front of mind. He's going to be president in a few days. We're recording this on a Sunday. And in 5 days, on Friday... 6 days?
It's the 20th. January the 20th.
January the 20th. So. Donald Trump is going to be the 46th president of the United States. The first orange president, which I think is fantastic.
It's a great step forward for race relations.
Yeah,
in that sense.
Pretty, oh, God. Just, like... very funny, but also my sternum just collapsed. And then, secondly, as you may tell, because of the ways that sounds come out of our mouths, we're British, so we're going to talk about British politics for a little bit, if you will bear with us, dear international listeners. Because the Labour Party, who are meant to be the opposition to our government, are going for a rebrand at the moment, slash everyone's leaving. So
a lot of rebrands involve, you know, mass exodus of staff, so, you know.
Yeah,
it's a thing.
So the leader of the
leader of the Labour Party,
the leader of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, doesn't want there to be free movement, but movement, but wants there to be control over migration, but doesn't really care about the controls over migration. So it's really clear the direction that Labour are going to be going in.
Clear as mud.
Yeah. Also, Tristram Hunt left, and he was, like, in my top seven hottest MPs.
Was he number seven?
No, they're kind of all at the top. But Andy Burnham's leaving. He was in my top seven. Zach Goldsmith has left.
Andy Burnham looks like a Thunderbird.
Yeah, but, like, harking back to my childhood, isn't it? Walking like a puppet.
You're getting aroused by, you know, a mannequin, basically. Yeah.
But all of the sexy MPs are leaving. It's very sad.
I sort of want to know who the other four are now.
I'll think about it and Chuka.
Maybe write a BuzzFeed-esque list and put on the website. Yeah, we'll get in trouble for objectifying men.
Is this you trying to get me to actually write for the Right to Solve?
It's me trying to get hits on the website. You know?
Yeah. Do you remember when I wrote that thing that one time?
Yes, I do. Yes. That was great. Fun was had by all. It was about Trump. Should we talk about Trump properly now that we've outlined the topics?
Yeah.
So what is it that happened in the last... Or what two things happened in the last week that made the news about Trump?
Shall we do it in chronological order? So, a dossier.
Dossier.
Yeah, it's definitely not dossier. You were saying dossier earlier, but that's fine. You've seen dossier. It written down a lot. Maybe not heard of the radio or the television. I won't judge.
I'm going to stick with dossier.
It is wrong, though.
I'm happy with that. I'm comfortable.
Okay, so...
this document.
There's this document that a British intelligence person released or leaked or investigated. Do you want to explain?
Yeah,
I don't really understand.
Roughly.
All I know is that some prostitutes pissed on a bed.
Yes. So some Republican opponents of Donald Trump decided to hire this guy who I think is called Christopher Steele, I can't entirely remember, who's a former MI6 intelligence officer, to compile just information about Donald Trump that could potentially be used to discredit him. That appears to be the origin of the document.
As if there wasn't enough already.
Yeah, I don't know why you'd need to go undercover to dig out more dirt. I don't even know that releasing... I mean, what were they expecting to find that would have, you know, I don't know.
Anyway.
The mind boggles. Anyway, this document, I think it's about 30-odd pages, and it includes a lot of salacious details, one of which Jazza has referenced...
Was there anything else? So basically, it said that Donald Trump... One of the things in this dossier was that Donald Trump went to Moscow and someone paid for a couple of prostitutes to piss on a bed that Obama once slept in.
Yeah. That's, and they apparently filmed it. And apparently the KGB...
Yeah,
or it's called the FSB now, but
I mean, it was on Snapchat somewhere. Like,
probably.
Like, you're not going to pay for that.
I think this was a while ago. This might be pre-Snapchat.
Oh, goodness. That's exciting.
This apparently happened.
Was there anything else in the dossier? Because everybody is focusing on the piss.
That's because, it's funny.
It is quite funny. It's also scarily believable in the same way that Cameron putting his penis in a pig's head was quite believable.
Well,
probably didn't happen.
There's been a bunch of allegations about contact between Donald Trump's campaign staff and Putin's administration. Basically, which suggests that there's very close involvement between the two of them. I mean, that's been suggested already. This just digs out further details. This document was circulating among the American government. Donald Trump and Barack Obama have been briefed on its details.
I love that they've been briefed on its details.
Yeah.
I think that's brilliant.
Well, you don't want to have to read the whole thing.
Imagine the face that Barry Obama has got. on his, when he's like hearing that. And yeah, that's probably just
it's probably just his permanent expression now of disappointment and a loss of faith in events.
He's fine. He's going to move to the Bahamas or something. He's going to have a lovely time.
Yeah, and then just watch his legacy get torn.
I remember when I thought that like Hillary Clinton was going to make him
a knight,
a justice. No, one of the Supreme Court justices, just to troll all of the Republicans. I thought that was going to be brilliant.
Yeah, but so they were briefed on this, and then the document was leaked to the press somehow, as often happens with these things. And apparently it's been circulating around the press, even before the election.
Yeah.
It was the impression I had. And CNN earlier this week decided to do a very carefully worded report about how it had been briefed to government officials, but they didn't really substantiate any of the details.
Yeah.
So they didn't reveal the golden showers moment, as it's become known.
It's now called Golden Gate.
Which Golden
I
Gate.
Think is brilliant.
That's pretty good, actually. Probably the first appropriate use of the word gate since Watergate itself. I think it was a couple of days after this, BuzzFeed decided just to slab the document on the internet and see what happens. And
which is brilliant, right?
So there's this whole... I personally think they shouldn't have done that.
Yeah, but that's because you're a journalist and you think that you have, like, integrity or something. Whereas BuzzFeed are just trolling now. They're turning themselves into the anti-Breitbart.
No, I think there's a respectable tradition of... which, to some degree, is exemplified by WikiLeaks, although I'm not defending everything WikiLeaks has ever done, of releasing information to the public. And there's also a tradition of just mischief-making and whatever, which I actually think is fair and can be used. But my point would be that BuzzFeed very strongly allied itself with... my impression of BuzzFeed is that they complained about fake news and that sort of thing. They weighed in on that whole event, and now they've essentially contributed to fake news, but just
they're fighting fire with fire.
Yeah, but I don't think my point is I don't mind people fighting fire with fire, but it is hypocrisy to take a moral high ground and then just wallow in the sludge yourself.
Yeah, but I'm kind of okay with that because. They have fought really hard to be taken vaguely seriously as a news organisation.
Yeah.
In order to have, like, exclusive interviews with people in power and all of that kind of stuff. And I think they realise that they're not going to have any of those privileges under a Donald Trump president. He doesn't like them anyway. He has nothing to gain from talking to them and giving them exclusive access. And so I think that they feel the best job that they can do is poking the sleeping dragon.
I should say, when this document was released, there was this internal BuzzFeed email from Ben Smith, who's the editor-in-chief of BuzzFeed, where he defended the decision in really highbrow terms, said, oh, this was a really difficult decision for us. He refers to the ferocious reporting in front of the reporters who was involved in publishing the document. And, I mean, that kind of clashes, basically. If he'd been kind of like Milo Yiannopoulos, who we seem to endlessly refer to on this podcast, and just be like...
Until he's on. He just got a book deal worth 200 grand.
Yeah, I saw his book being advertised. But he's like... advertises himself and publicises himself as a provocateur. That's the word he uses.
And he's a human troll.
Yeah, he's a troll. That's like part of his thing. And as I said, I think there's a space for that within journalism as a whole. But BuzzFeed didn't defend it on those terms. They defended it on the notion that the public should be able to examine the claims and decide for themselves. But there's no way that anyone could read the document and decide whether the claims were true unless they had access to their own intelligence service.
Yeah, but we all read that and thought that could happen.
It could happen.
Didn't we?
Yeah, it's plausible.
I'm very curious to see how these media organisations, not just BuzzFeed, but also CNN, who were shouted down in Trump's press conference and told that they weren't allowed to ask any questions because they are fake news. One of the most respected broadcast platforms in the Western world, CNN.
Yeah, so CNN did report it carefully. So,
in a very responsible way.
Yeah.
Right? But no, fake news. I'm really curious to see how these media organisations that are going to end up being shut out by the Trump presidency, how they're going to go about doing their business. And I think that BuzzFeed has like set out its trench, have decided this is the war that we're going to fight. And I quite like that. I admire the gumption. It's going to be entertaining, if anything.
Is there not a obvious possibility that this will further entrench the partisanship within US politics, and it will make it harder for people from either side of the aisle to talk to one another?
Donald Trump, I don't think, is the kind of president who it's going to be possible to reach across the aisle and have a dialogue with. I think that's even going to be difficult with the people who are meant to be in the same party as him. You see how Lindsey Graham and like Marco Rubio and John McCain are talking about and lamenting this softness on Russia that Trump has.
So those are all Republican?
Those are all Republican senators.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to be really... I think he's actually got quite a tough... few years ahead of him in terms of getting stuff done, because there's also the repealing of Obamacare, and Obamacare really does need to be replaced by something.
There is this argument that Obamacare was pushed through knowing it was flawed on the basis that the next president would have to repair it in some way.
Fix it in some way.
Yeah.
We're here. Because actually quite a lot of Republicans like... certain parts of Obamacare. They have like general sweeping sadnesses about it, and that it costs too much and blah 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 blah.
Wasn't it based on ideas that Mitt Romney came up with or something like that?
It was based loosely on Massachusetts's public health care system.
Yeah.
And it's very convoluted in the way that it ensures that it's not just a place where loads of sick people go, because then it would be really expensive. It has to have people who are of all ages, people who are of all like stages of health, in order for it to work. And it basically works as a mini NHS within the United States, which is very difficult when you have such a strong private sector. But I don't think that taking away Obamacare is... I mean, if they take it away and they don't replace it with something, then there's going to be several million people without healthcare again.
Yeah. There's been this interesting thing relating to Obamacare, in which Congress is currently pushing for...
Obamacare, by the way, is also referred to as the Affordable Care Act, which apparently some people who want to repeal Obamacare are struggling to understand.
Well, they probably see it as the unaffordable...
They're like, oh yeah, I'm on ACA... But get rid of Obamacare.
Apparently. Oh, I see what you mean.
I've seen memes, and I'm willing to think that they're
true. But related to the Obamacare thing, Congress is trying to get itself power to repeal like federal regulations and all sorts of other stuff. So it's actually pushing to...
Take away powers from the president.
Exactly, yeah. So the federal agencies sit underneath the president, and they're largely
answerable to the
president. Some of them are answerable to Congress in various ways to do with funding and that sort of thing.
I just want them to take away the nuclear codes from him and make sure that he has to consult people first.
Is he able just to fire nuclear missiles on his own?
He can just fire nuclear... Because he... Like, in theory, a sane president has to. They have to make a split decision in, like, 15 minutes or something to decide whether or not they're going to perform mutually assured destruction. That is genuinely quite scary, because he's a massive baby.
Do you think there's a possibility that... Because he won't be making that decision sat in a room by himself. There'll be people around him. And do you think there's a possibility
Have you seen the people that he surrounded himself with?
It's... Well, yeah, I mean, it's not ideal, but...
It's not ideal. Jimmy Nichols, the raving optimist.
I'm just saying, you know, there's a chance that one of them might think, this is actually not a great idea. I think I'm just going to take this guy out of the game.
We could just do what David Attenborough said, what he suggested.
What did he suggest?
We could just shoot him.
I mean, there's a chance that someone else might take that initiative anyway.
I'm hoping that Theresa May does it when she does her visit.
Yeah.
In the spring.
That would be controversial, I think.
Yeah, but like, you wouldn't put it past her, would you? You know what though? That press conference, which was just crazy. He like, tried to talk about the fact that he was... the point of the press conference, which nobody really cared about, was that he was putting his assets in a blind trust. That isn't a blind trust. That is being run by his sons, but he's still going to know what's happening. And he can't divest, so he's done his best. And basically trying to show that you don't need to worry about there being other kind of influences in the president's decision making based on the Trump Corporation.
There's this interesting thing related to that, that there's a Trump hotel in Washington, and apparently the prices for in that hotel have skyrocketed in, like, since Donald Trump was elected as president of the US. And there's a suggestion, or at least this is the inference I got when somebody told me the story, that foreign powers and companies that want to effectively bribe Trump by the back door will buy hotel rooms and go there and buy lots of expensive food and drink and that sort of thing, which will then put the money into his back pocket, but not so directly as an, you know, an overt bribe.
Yeah, I've heard this as well, and I don't really buy it.
Really?
Because how much can you get from somebody going to a hotel room and spending and ordering the lobster?
Rack up the room service, mate.
Yeah, but I don't really buy that. What I do worry about is his business ventures abroad. So he's meant to be investing hugely in Latin America. He's meant to be in investing hugely in the Middle East. And that's where I'd be worried about. Where he'll be able to get insight into what those countries are doing through the back door and benefit his family. That I think is super. But it was so odd, because just like about 15 minutes in, he just left, and then some lady turned up and read something. She gestured to a load of like brown envelopes on a table. And I hope that this is a running theme in his presidency, the use of props.
Right.
Because he did previously, to prove how successful he was, have all of the Trump line of products, which is like wine and steak and all of those like luxury things. He did that before. And now we've got the brown envelopes. And I hope that he just generally does, if he does something about mining, he just has a pile of coal next to him. I think that would be quite, like, the aesthetics would be quite pleasing. But the whole thing was so mad that it made me...
What was in the envelopes? Or what was the significance of the envelopes?
I don't really know. Oh. Stuff about his business.
Were people allowed to look in the envelopes? Or?
No, of course not. They were a prop. They were just a prop, Jimmy. And then he started screaming fake news at CNN. And then he was asked quite loudly and clearly, did anyone from your team have contact with anybody from Russia during the campaign? And he didn't answer it three times and then left. So I feel really good about Brexit now, because it's nowhere near as bad as Trump.
Is that a genuine thing, or...?
No, genuinely. I was like, oh, you know what? Brexit is not that bad. I don't feel good about Brexit.
Right.
Like, I'm not stupid.
Like other people around the table.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey. I don't feel positive about it, but I'm like, oh, the UK is still going to exist.
Well, maybe a nuclear war will start and, you know, you won't have to worry about anything ever again.
Because I'll be dead. Yeah, that's a brilliant, brilliant fail-safe.
Silver linings, mate.
Silver linings.
Speaking of silver linings, should we awkwardly segue over to the Labour Party?
Yes, let's.
Yeah. Jeremy Corbyn appears to have tried for a rebrand, although it appears...
Who started calling it a rebrand?
I'm not sure, but
it's... Because it wasn't really, was it? It was a, I'm going to stay the same brand.
Well, I think the line was leaked by Labour press officers, and...
Right, so that's what they've been calling it.
Yeah, but in the usual vein of Corbyn's press office, they say this is about to happen, and then nothing really transpires, you know?
Yeah, I mean, he was meant to be... So the way that I understood it, he was meant to be... launching Labour's new take on immigration, right, and saying that we needed to have controls over our borders. And then, and like, this was being primed by quite a lot of Labour MPs. Andy Burnham has shifted drastically to the right.
He's been denounced quite severely for that, hasn't he, by some people?
But all of the, like, centre ground, what would traditionally perceived as the centre ground members of parliament for the Labour Party, have kind of all decided that this is how Labour win, like, get some seats. We ended up with Caroline Flint saying that having more brown people in her constituency was a bad thing.
She presumably didn't literally say that.
No, she said. She did say that it was troubling for people that her constituency was 5% less white than it was 10 years ago. Or 15 years ago or something.
I mean, that's pretty straight down the line.
I used to quite like her. I thought she had gumption. And now she's willing to be a racist.
To some degree, though, I mean, well, in the last 10 years and since the kind of Eastern European countries joined the EU, the public's attitude to migration has diverged very significantly from the attitudes of, say, David Cameron's Tories, as in the front bench, and even Ed Miliband's Labour Party as well. So is this not just, to some degree, a logical realignment of politicians who are supposed to represent the public with the public?
Yeah, I suppose.
Well, I mean,
it's really fucking depressing, though, because it is xenophobia. It's politicians being happy to pander to xenophobia. Convince me otherwise, please.
So the way I see it is there are probably quite a lot of people in Britain who are xenophobic, and that is one of the reasons, perhaps even the main reason, that they oppose migration. But there's also, like, the fact that the places where they live have changed an inordinate amount, really without their consent, particularly. And I'm thinking of places like Boston is the famous example, because that saw a huge influx of Eastern European migration.
Boston, England, not
yes, Boston,
Boston
England.
Massachusetts. Just so that everybody
just
is
for
clear.
Our American listeners.
Yes.
But there is something, irrespective of how you feel about migration, there is something a little bit ripe about the idea that decisions made in London can radically alter other parts of the country. I mean, London is pretty relaxed about migration, I think, although there is this whole story about white flight from London out to the suburbs, which, you know, maybe does counter that somewhat.
But then gentrification.
Yeah, gentrification is...
Which is the opposite.
...is overturning that. The gentrification example is actually, I think, quite interesting, because they're progressives, I think, and I put you in this camp for this particular issue, are very relaxed about, ethnic migration into a particular area of London. Mm-hmm. Say, Brixton used to be, you know, at the end of World War II, Brixton was white, and then after World War II, you had the Windrush migration, and Brixton
the
became...
The Windrush migration being Afro-Caribbean.
Afro-Caribbean.
From the... they would have been Caribbean.
Yeah.
Afro-Caribbean.
Yeah, yeah. It's,
oh, God.
It's a very...
Race.
It's a really interesting, like, example of how, like, Britain changed post-World War II, and they brought in the black migration because
the country needed to be built.
There was a labour shortage, right, for just unskilled labour. And
there was a world war and many people died.
But my point is that progressives tend to be very relaxed about that sort of migration, but gentrification, where you have essentially rich people coming in and displacing poor people, they tend to be a lot more severe about. And to a great degree, I think these two phenomena are similar. Because you have people whose communities change rapidly over a period of several years, where outsiders come in and displace them, effectively. Jasmine is pulling a face at me right now.
I feel like the process is similar, but I think they're very different.
In what
but
way?
I don't know
why.
How to counter that yet. So I feel like they're very different because of the results of it.
Okay.
Because I don't think that white flight is actually like a huge problem. I don't think the people that ended up leaving, like the East End. My gran is unfortunately quite xenophobic. She loves using the word gollywog left, right, and centre. I think it's more because she likes the word and how it feels in her mouth rather than her views towards like people of colour.
Right.
But she's a little bit xenophobic. And she really.
So your gran was presumably part of the EastEnders who moved out to Essex.
Yeah, and so she was like from Dagenham, and Dagenham is now very, very ethnically diverse. I think that actually white Brits are not the majority there.
I mean, throughout London, white British natives, like, a bit contentious how you define that, but white British natives are a minority across London when you add it all up.
But she moved out because she got well-to-do and she moved out of a dodgy area.
Yeah, that was part of the reason.
And there's this idea of white flight being, like, people feeling uncomfortable around people of different cultures and therefore leaving. But I think that those movements were more economically driven than socially driven. Whereas when gentrification happens, people are literally priced out of homes that they've had sometimes for generations. And gentrification doesn't just happen, I mean, neither of these happen exclusively along racial lines.
No.
But you see gentrification happening to white people as much as with ethnic minority communities. That's why I think they're different. They are meant to be talking about Jeremy Corbyn.
They are different, but I mean, I suppose it is an interesting tangent about the immigration. I think is actually is obviously one of the key.
How do you feel about immigration? I know you don't usually like talking about your own views,
right?
But how do you feel about immigration?
Well, I'm dominated by my co-host who just can't stop talking. I'm pretty conflicted about it, to be honest. I'm not really sure what I think about it, because I can kind of see both points of view, which is why I tend to play devil's advocate, because you're very in the pro-migration camp.
Yeah.
But
I'm not so much in the pro-migration camp. I'm in the I don't care. So I'm in, like, I am not affected by large amounts of migration.
You actually quite like diversity, though, don't you?
I also quite like diversity, so I'd say probably pro.
I'd say that puts you a bit more in the pro, but yeah, maybe in the main, maybe you're not that bothered. But I think the displacement argument does have some traction. I think the people who are making that argument do have a point. As I said, I think xenophobia has obviously something to do with it as well. But it does seem to me that people who want to, this is going to sound like a very generous phrasing of xenophobia, but people who want to, say, live in a ethnically homogenous and culturally homogenous community, that seems to me to be a legitimate preference. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Not really.
Fine.
Well, in the same way that some people like really diverse cities, and I would classify myself as one of those people.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't like really diverse cities, if you actually prefer to live in a culturally homogenous area, I don't really see why one of those preferences is morally superior to the other. It just seems to me to be a preference. And it seems to me that people should have some control over how their communities are going. And I think one of the reasons that Brexit happened was, irrespective of whether the area a particular voter had lived in had become much more diverse, there was an indisputable loss of control on the part of the British government as far as migration went. Because
But the people who ended up voting for Brexit were often those who didn't have first-hand experience of...
I think this point is actually widely disputed, because Boston is one of those areas that did vote.
Yeah, you're giving
Brexit
me like a play, but it was Northern England and like Middle England, right, that voted for Brexit.
I think Civitas have disputed the link between cultural homogeneity and the an opposition to migration. So the line that has been put out, I haven't actually looked into this myself, but the classic line was, it's the people who are most opposed to immigration are people who don't live in areas where migration has affected them very much.
Mm-hmm.
But I understand that this has been disputed by, I think it's Civitas, which is a think tank. I haven't looked into it, as I say.
Cool. I find that difficult to believe, because from personal experience, it has tended to be with like people that I've spoken to up and down the country when I'm on my like outreach tours. I have experienced generally people who are from more homogenous areas are scared of that homogeneity being taken away from them by a perception of large amounts of people coming from other cultures.
But maybe that's not just that's not a perception thing. Maybe people who, I mean, this is almost obvious, people who prefer diversity will tend to gravitate towards cities when they move, and people mm-hmm. who prefer homogeneity can barely say it, will gravitate towards more homogenous areas.
Mm-hmm. But so that kind of link between an increase, so for example, people who live in Margate, which is one of the most anti immigrant places that I've ever been to, they will go to London and be like, I used to live here when I was younger, when I was like 20 and 30, and I don't recognise this city anymore because there's people who wear headscarves and there's people who talk with like Mandem accents and all of that kind of stuff.
Well, there are
and they see that change as something that's been caused by migration, and then they see their kids who have fewer economic opportunities and they see that change and they're like, oh, that's why that's happened.
Yeah, I think you're right that there's been a general perception of cultural decline in which they've associated with migration. I think you've been slightly ungenerous. There are parts of London which are not English anymore, to all intents and purposes, or not very English at least.
Sure, but that has always that's been the case for a very long time.
I don't think that's actually true, and I think you're about to trot out the mongrel race line.
No,
where are you about to go with this?
I don't know what that is.
The mongrel race line is that Britain is an island nation. It's always been a mongrel race. We've always been affected by mass migration.
I feel very indifferent to that phrasing. We have like a Jewish community just up the road from me that is very, very insular. I live in northeast London. The Jewish community occupies a significant part of Tottenham.
Yes.
And they have been there for hundreds of years. We have...
This is the Huguenot migration referencing.
Yeah. We have like huge pockets of like Indian and Pakistani migration that have been here for generations, not just from the Windrush generation.
That's mostly post-World War II.
It is mostly post-World War II, but they've been in East London for hundreds of years.
Not in large numbers.
But there's been communities there for hundreds of years.
There's been small numbers for maybe, well, I don't know, hundreds of years.
But those are pockets of communities.
No, I mean, England up until...
There's this perception that we used to all... We all used to look like one another and hold hands and, like, run ribbons around the maypole. But that never bloody happened. Everybody hated each other.
Yeah, I mean, you know... I think the notion that people are hearkening back to a nostalgic era where everything is perfect is often used to discredit people who are sceptical about migration. I mean, you just did it there.
Yeah.
I don't think that's what's being argued. I mean, culturally, Britain was very homogenous up until World War II, arguably. The post-World War II years, Britain has changed very significantly. And that is true irrespective of whether you think that's a good thing or a bad thing. In terms of in large groups of people from the former British Empire, largely, the Commonwealth, coming in and establishing communities in largely in big cities.
Yeah, I mean, but that made the UK like more diverse than places like Germany, for example.
Is England more diverse than Germany?
I don't know, but I'm thinking in terms of historically, the fact that we had like a global empire really did mean that we were a gateway to the rest of the world, and we had communities here, which is why we've had communities here from what is now India.
I think you're overstating the amount of migration that there previously was. I mean, Britain was a global trading empire,
but that's because migration was low. Like the world over, because travel was hard.
Yeah, I agree.
We now have planes.
Yes.
I don't know if you've noticed.
Yeah, I think that's the reason that countries are much more diverse than they used to be, is the ease of travel.
So Jeremy Corbyn has been
circling back.
Yeah. See how smoothly I did that.
Yeah, well, it wasn't smooth at all, but
I'm ignoring you. Jeremy Corbyn seemed very puzzled with his own. He was meant to rebrand as like somebody who wanted to control migration and wasn't able to do that, probably because of his own personal
views. He's been pro-open borders for a while.
Yeah, yeah, he's very... And he's principled like that.
Yes. Stubborn,
but we now have like very high profile, or at least previously high profile, members of parliament like Tristram Hunt leaving to go and do other things. There's also
Tristram Hunt has left to head up the
Victoria and Albert Museum,
which is a famous museum in London.
It's a famous museum. They do very nice V&A late things. They have DJs there in the evenings.
Mm.
It's very lovely.
Yeah.
Good date option, if anybody is that way inclined.
I mean, this thing about to circle back.
If you take it back to migration, I think I'm going to punch you. But
no, I'm going to take it back to Jeremy Corbyn is always portrayed as this super principled guy.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, since he's become leader, he's deviated from his principles quite significantly. I mean, he was very sceptical about the European Union. He actually voted for Britain not to remain in the European Economic Community in the 75 referendum.
Yeah, because then it was the left-right divide was generally switched.
Yes, it was.
So Labour wanted to leave and the Conservatives wanted to enter.
Yes. It wasn't enter, we had already entered.
Had we already entered?
Yeah, we already entered then. Harold Wilson held the referendum to solidify the decision.
Good old Harry.
But yeah, he says, like, he openly backed the Remain campaign, but there were very heavy hints that he might be more inclined to vote Leave.
Mm-hmm.
He's an open borders guy, seemingly. I mean, he's an international socialist. He's not an English socialist or a national socialist.
Mm-hmm.
But
a national socialist being a Nazi.
Yeah. but he's actually equivocated on this issue. Like, he said, like, I'm not going to back open migration, but I'm not ruling it out either.
Mm-hmm. He's trying to have his cake and eat it, because he wants to be able to stay to his principles, which actually I do admire.
But how is this any more deceitful than Tony Blair's equivocating? I mean, if anything, it is more deceitful, because Corbyn has principles but won't say them, whereas Blair largely was very flexible about his politics.
Yeah, but that's because Jeremy Corbyn is having his arm twisted behind the scenes. Like, he's being told, you have to say this. You have to say that you're voting to stay in the
EU. But if he was that principled, if he was that principled, he'd be forced to confront the fact that he's not suited at all, really, to leading a mass party of a mass coalition of the left.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's too much of a hardliner.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to lead a mass party of the left or the right, you have to be somewhere on the moderate, somewhere towards the centre, or at least somewhere in the middle of the two or three or four big wings of the party. And he's not suited towards that role.
And he also, it's quite frustrating because I don't think that he, and this is like a common phrase that is used with quite a lot of commentators. I don't think he wakes up and wants to be prime minister. I don't think that he wakes up and thinks, how am I going to become prime minister?
Did you see that interview? I think it was with Jon Snow, perhaps, where Jon Snow asked him, do you want to be prime minister? And Jeremy Corbyn was like,
I want to be in government.
Yeah,
he
said something very...
Didn't just say yes.
He said something very vague, and then Jon Snow said, I want the words to come out of your mouth, I want to be prime minister. And Corbyn refused to say it.
Yeah, as if it's like... so that's... What he wants to do is to be able to mould the Labour Party into the kind of party that he should be leading.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? So getting rid of the Tristram Hunts is actually, like, perfect for him.
Yeah.
But it's very sad, because while they're sorting that shit out, it means that the government are able to put things through, like the Snoopers Charter, and are able to define Brexit without there being an opposition working on it as well.
I think it is worth pointing out, though, I'm reading this book by this political scientist or political academic called Anthony King, who died recently. And he makes the point in this book that the opposition in Parliament actually can't do very much. They can shout at their opponents, and potentially they can embarrass them if the right time comes up.
Select committees are quite important, aren't they?
I'm not sure about that. I guess it probably depends.
From our perspective, no, they don't like make. They don't decide the steering of government.
Right.
But I think that the power that they do have, especially in terms of the mechanisms of government and how and what stuff can go through, especially when you have such a slim majority at the moment, Labour Party could be so powerful right now, and they aren't able to be. Because of the fact that there is no leadership.
I don't know that they could be, because there's, what, 59 Scottish...
SNP. But if they joined with the SNP...
Yeah, but they are very different tendencies at this point.
They do have very different tendencies, but they both hate the Tories.
Yeah, I guess so.
Which is enough. I don't think it's enough to be in coalition together in a government, but I think that it's enough to stop a Tory government from working.
I suppose if Labour was willing to take a very hard line against Brexit, and the SNP already kind of have or would like to, and the Lib Dems have, and there were enough rebellious Tory MPs, which I think there would be in theory, but whether in practice they would actually do this, you would probably have enough of a blocking majority to block Brexit in Parliament. But if you don't have the will to do that, and I don't think the will does exist, because I think the sense is that the referendum has to be honoured, then what sort of scrutiny are you expecting, or what sort of... They can't block it, so all they can do is scrutinise it and reform it in various ways, but...
That's exactly what I want. I want there to be some kind of a say and a ballot. So I am evolving on the issue of hard or soft Brexit.
Okay. Where were you before?
I want us to be as close to being members of the European Union as possible. Probably shifting away from that. And I'm quite similar to you, I think, now. That if Brexit happens, I think we just have to slice everything off and appreciate that it's going to be a really shit, like, decade.
So, but that appears to be where Theresa May is going, so why do you want
it
more
does,
scrutiny?
But I still don't
opposition?
Want it to happen. So my ideal scenario is Brexit not happening still.
Okay.
You see how conflicted I am.
Yeah, I mean, actually, I would prefer Brexit to not happen rather than a soft Brexit to happen, so I suppose we're sort of mirror images of one another in that sense.
Oh god, haven't we always just been that though?
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know, I think with Corbyn, you're probably, this isn't an original opinion, but the Labour Party is probably just it's on a trajectory to permanent decline.
No, I don't think that is going to happen.
You don't reckon so?
No, because I don't think that the Lib Dems are in a place to replace them. Because they are really the only ones south of the Scottish border who are able to replace the Labour Party.
Well, I think UKIP still have the potential to do damage to them in various seats.
So there are... So Stoke-on-Trent Central, I believe, is Tristram Hunt's seat.
Yes, it is, yeah.
Where UKIP are in second, I believe.
So the way it breaks down is that at the 2015 general election, Tristram Hunt for Labour got 12,000 and something votes, and the Tories in UKIP got 7,000 apiece, which obviously 14,000 is more than Labour would have. Apparently, I read this on Twitter. So
isn't first past the post brilliant?
It's questionable. but I read this on Twitter.
It's actually a right wing seat is being represented by Tristram fucking. That's hilarious.
Well, some people don't vote for UKIP for right wing reasons. They might not even see themselves as right wing. They vote for them because they feel that the major parties have let them down.
Yeah, the shift into a new paradigm of politics is also confusing things, isn't it? Left right doesn't exist anymore.
I don't think it really does, except that people continue to behave as if it does.
Yeah,
so
it's because
to that extent,
people
it does
who are political commentators, they learnt it at school.
Yeah, but it's not just them, it's actually the parties themselves. And, you know, the Tories and Labour don't really have any incentive to abandon the whole left-right paradigm in terms of how they think about things.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, because it's convenient for them, but I think that the Tories are able to reposition themselves so that they occupy this paradigm, which is, I think that it's going to be more along nationalist and internationalist. That seems to be the one that makes the most sense at the moment, with somebody like the Lib Dems and the Greens being the most internationalist, Labour coming second, then the Tories, then UKIP being super nationalist.
Maybe I just I'm
not supra nationalist. I should say super.
Yeah, yeah. I just
those are very different things.
They are very different things. I'm just not sure that I see a realignment as very possible at the moment. Because the last, I mean, I guess the last one arguably was when Labour took over the mantle of the Liberals, and then the Liberal Party collapsed. And but there was the whole thing about popular suffrage had just come in, and you know. I suppose, yeah. I don't know about that. I think that the Corbynites have captured the Labour Party. They've properly captured it. Like, in the past, Momentum had a good go of it, and there have been various other attempts to... the militant tendencies that thinking of, who were, like, very hardline socialists, and they thought that any deviation from that was a betrayal of socialist principles. Neil Kinnock, the Labour leader during the 80s, managed to defeat them, but those guys in the form of Momentum have now won. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just over for Labour as a moderate left-wing party. And because of that, I think they will continue to go down the Corbynite path. I don't think there's any reason to think that that would change unless, you know, maybe a huge number of non-Corbynites join the Labour Party, which at this point appears unlikely. Because so long as Labour members vote Corbynite or vote for his successor, his general point of view, the Labour Party will continue to behave as a Corbynite party. And that's it.
So, rebrand, successful or unsuccessful?
About as much of a failure as anything has been in history.
Brilliant. Excellent. There's something that I wanted to kind of touch on at the end of this podcast, because we are ending it.
Yes.
I'm sorry to say, listener.
He's kicking me out because he
Jimmy
wants to have his tea.
Yeah, I'm really hungry, and I have a tenderised steak looking at me at the moment. It's going to be brilliant. I think that we at TRD, Turd. Yeah.
Which is, you only refer to it as.
Yeah. I'm the only one who calls it Turd. We need to make sure that we don't just talk about Brexit and Trump, because then stuff happens that people should, like, if those things weren't happening, people would be up in arms about them. So stuff like the Snoopers Charter going through,
yes,
and mass collection of internet users' data in the UK, that happened over the past, like, month or so, and nobody's noticed. The NHS being, the war happening at the NHS at the moment kind of pokes its head through the news headlines every now and again, and then we're back to talking about Theresa May as and like how many colours of Brexit she's doing. All of the nominations for Trump's cabinet have happened over the last like few days and have had no coverage because of the fact that he's...
I wouldn't say they've had... Those things have had some coverage.
They've had some coverage.
I appreciate you're right that the general craziness of the Trump presidency and Brexit is overshadowing other news
stories.
Go on,
name me three of his cabinet appointments.
So, Mad Dog Mattis is... Mm-hmm. I don't know what his role is, but I've heard his name.
Mm-hmm. I'll give you a half point there.
Is he Defence Secretary?
Yes.
Yes, okay. There you go. There's other people. They're also available.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I only run a political podcast. I don't read the news all that often.
So I'm saying this so it's on the record. Jimmy, we need to try it harder. And dear listener, if there's anything that you think that the media have missed that you'd like us to look into and research and chat about, and Jimmy and I will at least pretend to disagree, we will do so. Please email us at the right dishonourable... What the fuck is our email address?
Rightdishonourable@gmail.com.
Yeah, or you can tweet us at rightdishonour, or you can find us individually. I'm at JazzaJohn on the Twitters.
I'm at JDE Nichols.
Excellent.
Or just Google, you know.
Or like just Google us. Yeah, fine. Also leave us stars and love us. Thanks, bye. But the 2017 isn't going to be better than 2016. And we're here to hold your hand and occasionally scream into your ears in frustration. Mainly me, let's be fair. Jimmy is very level-headed. You alright?
Yeah.
Good. Toodaloo.
Bye-bye.